Hey, everybody, welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name is Rick Polson. I'll be your host for the next hour or so as we discuss recent developments in the world of public safety labor relations. And hi to folks watching us on YouTube, which I understand is how most people listen to this, which is weird. So I have to like wear pants and stuff. This month is a solo episode. We're not going to be interviewing anybody this month. The point is for us to catch up on four pretty interesting cases. And so we're going to start, we like to go all over the country. So we're going to start up in the Pacific Northwest, which is a very interesting and concerning speech and privacy case out of Seattle. Then we're going to float down to California for another interesting speech case involving a firefighter's spouse. And then we're going to go back east. We're going to come over to the swamps of Jersey for two labor board cases. One involving a political end around, which is always fun, and another involving a prison staffing shortage with an outcome that I think was kind of unexpected, especially these days. So we have lots of ground to cover, plus a check-in on all things LRS when we return. So welcome to First Thursday. So what is up with LRAS, you may ask? Vegas, baby, that's what's up. We're in Vegas a lot this year. We're going to be in Vegas four times for the rest of 2025. We'll be there June 18th to 20th, September 10th to 12th for a grievances seminar, October 15th to 17th for our collective bargaining seminar, and November 5th to 7th. For our discipline seminar. And June seminar is Rights of Police. That's always a really good one. For those of you who don't love Vegas, what's wrong with you, man? It's fun. Nashville is also fun. And we just did a great seminar in Nashville in March. It was really, really good. So we're going to be there three times next year. We're going to be in Nashville in January for union leadership, in April for bargaining, and then in November for discipline. We'll be back in Vegas in like June and September, but we're going to do a lot in Nashville next year. So come see us in Vegas and come on out and see us in Nashville. For more information about any of those things, just check us out at lrs.com/seminars. I just got finished recording a webinar that was pretty cool on grievances. You know, we do webinars. They're pretty interesting. If you have any interest in any of that stuff, check it out at lrs.com/webinars. Finally, if you appreciate the podcast, please follow or subscribe or text it to your colleagues. If you have any suggestions for the podcast, just email us info@lris.com. Happy to get your comments and respond to them. And if you're feeling really charitable, maybe give us a review. The first case this month comes from the state of Washington in a dispute that we've talked about before, I think, on the podcast and at seminars coming out of the city of Seattle. All kinds of weird cases coming out of Seattle recently. Not sure what's going on with that, but the case is called John Doe's versus Seattle Police Department. It was decided by the Washington Supreme Court on February 13th. The losing party in that case, wait for it, I'll talk about it, has filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court to take the case. It would not surprise me if the court decided to take the case. And so we might be talking about this case for a couple more years. What does it start with? Any good case, any interesting case that we talk about can all come back to a Trump rally one way or the other. There's so many good cases coming out. He's the best thing that ever happened to lawyers, because there's so much litigation, pro, con, whatever, all around Trump. So this one has to do with the Stop the Steal rally. So, that was a biggie. And it comes out of the city of Seattle. And what happened was that six Seattle police officers, what are their names? Their names are all, they all have the same last name, Doe, Jane Doe, and five John Does. Case is about anonymity. The Does attended the Stop the Steal rally in the other Washington on January 6th of 2021. By the way, and if you research that and you look at like how many law enforcement officers and firefighters, were there, There's an estimate that they're less than 1%, less than actually a tenth of a percent. The number that we've seen reported is 0.06 of attendees at the J6 rally were police officers. So take that for what it's worth, but it's not like there were a ton of them there. But these guys go, they attend the rally, they express their beliefs. Most of them didn't get out of line. Two of them may have. We'll talk about that. But the others were just kind of there doing whatever they were doing. And they get back to Seattle. And they get back to Seattle, and maybe your police department is different from everybody else's police department. But in the city of Seattle, police officers tend to gossip. So, like every other police and fire and crime, it's just the way it goes. But word gets around after the shit hits the fan that, oh, we had six officers there, and what were they doing? And I saw Johnny hanging from the cap, all that kind of stuff, right? Word leaks out to the public, and Seattle's police department has an Office of Police Accountability, which is basically civilian oversight, anti-police, not friends of police or law enforcement. They get wind of it, and there's an investigation conducted, and they call these guys on the carpet to ask them about, their attendance at the rally. So they force these guys to sit for the OPA interviews, and they complied. And during those interviews, they were asked, what were their whereabouts on January 6th? What did they do on January 6th? Okay, you're entitled to investigate that, I guess. But then they also were asked about their political beliefs, right? And their association. So how do you feel about what happened? What political beliefs did you want to express? What political groups were there? Are you affiliated with any political groups? How did you feel about, everything that happened that day? Really digging into some personal stuff there. And the officers answered all the questions. They were ordered to answer questions. They answered all the questions. Okay, so what's the problem? OPA, not again, it's not like they're looking to clear cops. They clear them. They clear four of the six officers. Two of the officers were charged, charges against those officers were sustained. They were terminated. And those officers aren't involved in this case. Okay, so we have some officers who maybe did some bad stuff that day. Well, they're not involved in this case. But four of them were cleared, just completely cleared. And somebody, right, in the public files, essentially like an open records request, a public records request. And what do they want to know? They want to know who those police officers were, right? So who are our insurrectionist cops that the city is kind of sweeping under the carpet and covering up misdeeds by Seattle police? And you can imagine. And remember, this is the city of Seattle. It's not the most conservative city in America. And so the public there, or some of the people in the public there, feigned concern over this. And they asked the city, we want you to turn over the investigation records. We want to see whether you actually covered this up or not. And we want to know who these officers were that you cleared. The city in Profiles in Courage, some would say they had the right to say no to this request. They chose not to, and they notified the officers that they were going to turn the investigation information as well as their personnel files and everything over to these requesters. And so that's how we wind up in court, because the officers went to court seeking an injunction prohibiting the proposed release of their personnel records. That's how the case makes its way up through the court system. And in late 2023, the Washington State Court of Appeals issued a really great decision. It was really, I mean, I happen to agree with the decision, but aside from that, it was just really well articulated. It's a speech and an anonymity case, and sometimes courts can, I think, humbly suggest that they can lose their way on these cases. And the Washington Court of Appeals didn't. It's a great decision. And ultimately, the court sided with the officers regarding what they called political anonymity. And a great quote from that case. Let me read from it here. The does assert that the disclosure of their identities, right, in the records, would violate the First Amendment right to political anonymity. We agree. Both the does' attendance at the J6 rally and their compelled statements to investigators implicate the First Amendment. Exposure by the government of this information would impinge the DOE's constitutional right to anonymity in their political beliefs and associations, right? Their constitutional right to anonymity in their political beliefs and associations. What I do outside of work, to what extent should that matter? So long as I'm enforcing the law, I'm doing the job, right, that I have fairly and evenly. I'm doing a good job. Am I, whether I'm a Democrat or a Republican or an independent or a you name it, political party, why should that matter? And why should I be forced to disclose essentially a political alliance that would be associated with somebody who attended the J6 rally, I'm guessing was not a Biden supporter, right? So we thought that's where it ended. Pretty good decision, actually really well worded decisions. We talked about it at LRAS seminars. There was an appeal to the state Supreme Court that we were watching. The court sat on the case for a while until after the election and decided in February to overturn the Court of Appeals. Right. So I think at the very end of 23, the Supreme Court took the case, was briefed and argued in 24, and then in February of this year, the court issued its decision. It overruled the Court of Appeals. It's pretty interesting. The court, said that the lower court missed a pretty important fact here, right, regarding privacy and expectations of privacy. And the Supreme Court held that the DOES, the officers, didn't establish a constitutional privacy interest in their identities related to their attendance at what the court called a very public rally, right? So there, you may have a constitutional privacy interest in your identity in certain circumstances, but the court said here, this is a really public event that they went to. So can you go to this highly public event and then later say, well, I don't want anyone to know I'm at this event, right? They didn't conduct the event in a closet. They conducted it at the Capitol and then, well, I guess starting at the monument and then Capitol. But that the city in this instance wasn't required to impose that request. And that, in fact, the city's projected release of that information wouldn't have violated any of constitutional privacy rights of the officers. And let me quote from the Supreme Court, because this is a pretty interesting decision as well. And so they say this. They say this is not a case about whether public employees had a right to attend a rally in Washington. Right? This is not a case involving government action conditioning or prohibiting the exercise of such a right. Right. In fact, the officers here were not prohibited from attending a political rally. Court goes on to say, indeed, their public employer concluded that absent any illegal conduct, the officers had a right to attend the rally and that doing so wouldn't be grounds for any adverse employment action. The court goes on to say that though no one disputes the officers could engage in political expression and attend the rally, it does not necessarily follow that the fact of their attendance at such an event is private under the First Amendment. So we have the Supreme Court, making an interesting distinction there and protecting the officers' rights to engage in this political activity, but then saying on the back end, if you go to and you attend this very public rally that became even more public than people thought it would, I'm not sure that you necessarily can say that you've got the same right to political anonymity that you might choose to enjoy. Court also says that and talks about how public this was. Let me quote from the decision. Quote, both the rally and its purpose were widely publicized. The officers did nothing to hide their identities while attending the rally, and they were there among thousands of other people. The news media was there documenting it. And while political beliefs may be closely and personally held in general, these public employees made the choice to attend a highly publicized political event in public. So while their political beliefs are not in this record, and we draw no conclusions about them, our analysis turns on the public nature of the event, not its political meaning or the officers' beliefs. And so if the request, if rather than attending the Stop the Steal rally, the officers were at a Taylor Swift concert, or the officers were at a Philadelphia Eagles football game, why would they do that? Maybe a Seahawks game they might attend. But if they're at some other public event and there was a request, we want to know the officers who attended the Taylor Swift concert. It's essentially the same thing. And they say, well, you don't get to know that. Well, you went and you attended this public event. You essentially waived your privacy. You gave some of your privacy away, and then you can't turn around and claim anonymity. And so that's what the Supreme Court said. A pretty interesting case. The Court of Appeals decision was interesting. The Supreme Court decision is interesting, and the state Washington State Supreme Court is interesting. And whether the U.S. Supreme Court takes this case or not, we shall see. But the court hasn't been shy about dipping its toe, its collective toe, I guess it's nine toes, into speech issues. And so it remains to be seen. If they take the case, you'll read about it in the paper, and we'll certainly be talking about it more here. And so, pretty interesting case out of Seattle. All good cases come from Trump rallies. Our next case comes to us from the state of California, the city of Tracy. I didn't know where the city of Tracy was in California. I now know that it's kind of between San Francisco and Modesto, right? It's about 100,000 people that live there. And the name of the case is Vargas versus City of Tracy. It's a federal decision decided by the Eastern District of California last month. And so this case has to do with the fire department. It's another speech case. It's interesting because it's a perceived speech claim, which is you don't see these as much. And we've got a city council person, we've got the head of a fire department, and we've got a firefighter all tied in together here. So let's try to break it down. There's this guy's name is Patrick Vargas, and so he's been a firefighter in Tracy since 1994, right? Been around a long time, rose to the rank of division chief. In 2018, the city fire department merged with a suburban fire department to form a fire authority, something that happens out there, right? So it's a joint powers authority. So it's not purely a city department. And California people, you can correct me where I'm wrong about that. Okay. We also have someone named Randall Bradley, and Bradley became the fire chief of the department like 2015. And Bradley wanted to restructure the department and basically wanted to make the fire authority department independent of the city of Tracy. So we've got this chief that wants to kind of say, no, we're going to do our own thing. We don't really care what the city says. We want to run things on our own. All right, what's the problem? Patrick Vargas is married, which isn't ordinarily a problem. That can be a very nice thing. His wife's name is Veronica, and she's a city council member in the city of Tracy. She opposed the plan, right? She wanted to keep city control, I would gather, of the fire department, or at least some greater semblance of control than Chief Bradley wanted. So we have a political dispute over an important question of fire protection. We have an outspoken city council person opposing this transfer of power. She happens to be married to one of the firefighters. Now, the case says that Vargas and his wife avoided discussing the fire department autonomy plan, quote, to prevent marital tension, right? So who knows what's going on there? But the chief confronted Bradley. It's in 2019 when the crap starts hitting the fan here. And basically, the chief goes to Vargas and says, yo, your wife is screwing our plan here, and starts putting it on Vargas because of whatever his wife is doing as an elected official. And then Bradley starts, at least I can read, you can read literally in the case, and I can also read in between the lines on the page. Bradley then starts putting the screws to Vargas, right? He all of a sudden accuses him of time card fraud. But those allegations were not supported. They investigated. The investigation gets kicked. Bradley then comes up with another disciplinary investigation. There were harassment allegations apparently against Vargas that he thought were very important, and he wanted the city to investigate those. The city conducts an independent investigation, the city concludes that Bradley's personal investigation into these alleged harassment allegations was flawed, and that Vargas was the victim of that. Ultimately, Fire Chief Bradley fired Vargas in January of 22. And why did, if Bradley had it out for Vargas, why did he wait until January of 22 to fire him? Well, he couldn't do it before then because the fire authority wasn't the official employer of the firefighters yet, right? So we've got this power struggle between a fire chief or the head of the fire authority and the elected officials in the city. There's an outspoken city council person. The chief is going to take it out on her husband. And as soon as He's got official authority. The transfer goes through. The authority is now the official employer of the fire departments. As soon as that happened, boom, Vargas gets fired. Well, who'd have predicted that? What did Vargas do in response? He sued. And he sued everybody, right? The shotgun approach. He sued the city. And the city was probably like, hey, man, we're trying to help you. But he sued the city. He sued the fire authority. He sued Bradley. He sued everybody. And he raised a number of different claims as well he should have. And the case, the decision presents itself on a motion for summary judgment. And that's basically after a case has been filed and we've conducted discovery and we know all of the relevant facts and in theory, we know the law. We basically go to the court and say, there's no need for a trial here. We should win. We know what the evidence is. Here's our legal argument. Shouldn't we just probably win this now? Right. And that's how the case presents itself to the district court there in the Eastern District of California. And the court issued a bit of a split decision. It denied summary judgment for Bradley and for the fire authority on Vargas's First Amendment claims, which is the most important issue here. Vargas, I'm sorry, I'm going to get people confused, but Vargas, raises a First Amendment claim against Chief Bradley and against the fire authority. And it's a speech claim, but it's a perceived speech claim, right? And that's what's interesting. The argument was that by terminating him, the fire chief retaliated against Vargas based on the perception that Vargas was in cahoots with his wife about the restructuring plan, right? So the chief's automatically assuming you and your wife are in this together. You're supporting your wife. You're trying to screw my plan. And therefore, I'm going to fire you. That's the gist of the argument. And that's what we call perceived speech. Vargas is saying he's assuming that I took a position. He's assuming that I did something. And I didn't, right? At least that's what he says. I didn't. The court sided with Vargas. And the court cited this interesting case out of New Jersey. Heffernan, the city of Paterson, which I think is a lawn sign case, that held that a public employee can bring a First Amendment retaliation claim, right, based on what we call perceived speech, even if the employee didn't actually engage in the speech. And the court noted that Bradley's actions, the chief's actions, including like his push for this biased investigation into harassment, his decision to terminate Vargas as soon as he had the authority to do so. And by the way, the city investigated and the city said, no, Vargas didn't do anything wrong. The chief said, I don't care. I'm going to fire him. That was problematic. So there are genuine issues of fact that need to go forward at trial to determine whether or not the termination was pretextual or not. Other things that happened, the court, wound up letting the city out of the case. Because here the bad actor was actually the authority, was Bradley, not the city. For police officers who may be interested, well, one of the things that Bradley said is, well, I should have qualified immunity. And we all know what qualified immunity is. And the court said, no, not so fast here. I'm not sure that you're going to be entitled to qualified immunity in this case, and so the case is going forward. So we'll have to see what happens. Normally, unless there's some type of appeal, it goes to trial. It's probably going to end there. There'll probably be some type of resolution if you get past summary judgment. That may or may not involve somebody coming back to work or a check. And so, if anyone knows, right, as we move forward, how this case gets resolved, please let me know. I'm interested in it. We talk about it on the pod because this perceived speech, right, is the thing. If your spouse, if you're in a city and it's Mayor Polson is running for re-election, you're going to support candidate Smith, who's going to run against Mayor Polson. I don't know why would you run against Mayor Polson, but candidate Smith is running against Mayor Polson, and it's a smallish town. Where everybody knows everybody, and Councilperson Smith for mayor, lawn sign automatically appears on my front lawn, or the fire a firefighter's front lawn, and I'm the mayor in this scenario. I guess I get mad, right? And I'm gonna, give that firefighter a hard time for their political speech. And the firefighter says, "It's not my sign; it's my wife's sign," right? I mean, that's where this stuff comes up. You're alleging that I took some public position or I engaged in speech When I didn't, that was someone else's speech, what we call perceived speech. We don't see it that much because the speech cases that we see these days are all social media, and it's hard to say, oh, I didn't post that. My kid posted that. Although I have had that case. Any lawyer who does this work has had that case where somebody's at least said, oh, yeah, I didn't post that. The answer is usually, yeah, they did in fact post that. So interesting perceived case, perceived speech case out of California. We'll keep an eye on it. If there's any further developments, you can be sure we're going to talk about it. For case number three, we are going to head east to the great state of New Jersey and state capital of the city of Trenton for an unfair practice case in a matter that was decided by the state's Public Employee Relations Commission. It's called City of Trenton. It's PERC PRC number 2025-20. And, you know, this is an end around, I would say, case. These are always pretty interesting, right? You know, employers are prohibited generally, regardless of the state you're in, they'll be prohibited from engaging in what we call direct dealing, right? You can't do an end run around the union and talk directly to the members. If you have a proposal to change shifts, actually, there's going to be a 12-hour shift case we're going to talk about. But if we have a proposal to go from 8 hours to 12 hours and the union bargaining committee is saying no, I can't, you know, send an email to all of the bargaining unit members telling them, oh, here's all the reasons why a 12-hour shift will work. You can't do that. And I can't start pulling people off one by one and start lobbying them. That's improper direct dealing. It undermines the union. It generally is going to constitute an unfair practice. So the employer can't do an end around. What about the union? Well, you know, the issue here is if you work in the public sector, you elect your bosses and you do have a right to communicate with your elected officials, don't you? You know, even though they happen to be your bosses. And so it's a little bit more difficult to limit what we might call direct dealing between a union and elected officials. Because aren't you really doing an end run there around the employer's management representative, their administrator, or their bargaining team if you go and you talk to the mayor and council people about those issues? It's one of those things where what's good for the goose isn't necessarily good for the gander, and unions have a right to do that. Whether you should or the extent to which you should do that is just going to depend. So this case comes out of Trenton, and we have a city administrator by the name of Adam Cruz. And we have in New Jersey a couple different unions representing officers in the police department. We have a rank and file union, and then we have the Superior Officers Association that represents the, you know, basically the supervisory officers in the department. And we also have, and his name is Jason Woodhead, we also have a mayor, right, of the city of Trenton. And so what happens is in August of 22, the PBA president, Woodhead, sends an email to the mayor to talk about issues related to the internal affairs office in the city of Trenton. Now, this isn't like a complete, isn't a sneaky end around. Because he copies the business administrator on the email, and he sends this email, and he basically raises, you know, a number of concerns that they have regarding the internal affairs structure in the department. Now, mind you, this is the union representing the people who are doing a lot of the investigating, right? You know, the supervisors are going to be tasked with doing that. And so President Woodhead expresses concerns about the way that internal affairs is currently structured, and that it could, you know, because it really lacked any true independence within the department, it could, you know, be subject to political pressure and influence and things like that. And so Woodhead had suggested a number of changes to be made in internal affairs. Okay, well, fair enough. You know, you can send that to the mayor. Here are some suggestions on, you know, ways that we may do things better. You know, he suggested to change the command structure in IA to create some new supervisory positions, you know, and things along those lines. Well, you know, I don't know what Woodhead's motivations are. You know, what Jason, feel free to let me know, you know, if you were doing that to kind of, you know, I'm going to copy the administrator on this and I'm going to put the heat on him because I'm going right to the mayor and say, hey, here are some problems that this other guy's not addressing. Maybe that was the reason. Maybe he was just doing so out of respect to say, I have a right to talk to the mayor and I'm going to copy the business administrator so he doesn't think I'm doing an end around. I don't know, right? That's what's so interesting about this case. What I do know is that Cruz was not happy about that email to the mayor because on August 30, he re does a reply all, right, to the email. He responds to the email and he says, Woodhead's communication with the mayor. Not acceptable outside of the chain of command. And he sends this kind of snippy, nasty email. So here's the email. Lieutenant Woodhead, not Jason, right? Lieutenant Woodhead, this email to the mayor or anyone else above the chain of command is unacceptable. Now, this next part he put in all caps, so you know he must really mean it. No meeting should be placed on the agenda to entertain this behavior, right? Now we're back in regular. The only policymaker in the police department is Director Wilson, who reports to me. Any concerns should be brought to your supervisor, and your supervisor approaches the director. As the union president, you want to approach it from this angle. There's also a process. Be guided accordingly. What does that mean? Be guided accordingly. That's the email. City administrator kind of hits the roof. He sends a brushback pitch, right, to the union president, is how I understand it anyway. And so you can go a couple of different directions here. And I don't know what the underlying dynamic is. Sounds like it's not very positive. And what the union did was they filed an unfair practice charge. They said that that email from the business administrator to the union saying, not so fast, be very careful about those emails you sent, interfered with the union president's right to advocate for his membership. And in doing so, it violated New Jersey's Public Employer-Employee Relations Act. The city said, no, we didn't do anything wrong because, what Woodhead did was not a lawful execution of his authority as the president. He basically got out over his skis. The internal affairs organizational structure, that's something the city management people deal with. The mayor doesn't deal with that. And the union certainly doesn't deal with that. And it really, we talked about it's talking about deploying rank and file people who aren't even in his bargaining unit, all kinds of things that they came up with. And they avoided the argument that, well, yeah, but if you send an email like this that has a chilling effect, are you improperly retaliating against someone? The commission, this was issued by the full state commission. The commission decided that, Woodhead was right and that the business administrator's email, constituted, or I'm sorry, that Woodhead's email to the mayor constituted protected activity within the meaning of the act. The email, after all, directly concerned workplace issues involving the association and specifically the organizational structure of internal affairs and its impact of that structure on the association's members. The commission noted that the email just contained the association's recommendation on how things could better be deployed. It didn't request negotiations, didn't demand implementation of any type of proposal. It was a suggestion on ways to improve this. The commission did address the city's arguments that Woodhead got out over his skis by saying that, yes, reorganizing a department is going to be a managerial prerogative, and that's not going to be the type of thing that the association should be bargaining over. But they said the association didn't request bargaining over this. They just made a suggestion on a way to better organize things so that there are no skis to get out over. And the commission then moved on to say, well, what about this email? Does the tone of the email, the nature of the administrator's response constitute an unfair practice? The standard that they apply there, which is not unique to New Jersey, is that the employer is going to violate their state labor law if their action tends to interfere with the employee's statutory rights and otherwise lacks a legitimate substantial business justification. So that's going to be the standard that the commission applies. And that's not a unique standard looking across the country. So applying that standard, the commission determined that the business administrator's response, stating that his email was unacceptable and above the chain of command, and telling him to be advised moving forward. They didn't mention the all caps, which I thought was probably the best part, because he really means it. If it's in all caps, you really mean it, right? But generally, that email had a, according to the commission, had a disciplinary tone and, quote, tended to interfere with and could have a chilling effect upon Woodhead's exercise of protected rights. So the administrator sent this email. It was a disciplinary email, essentially, or had that tone, and that would tend to chill the association president in exercising his rights. They also found that the city, despite the fact that the city had managerial rights in the contract and that the things that that Woodhead was talking about were ordinarily managerial concerns, that wasn't a legitimate and substantial business justification for the chilling email, right? So the city's interest in maintaining the chain of command to the extent that the email even violated in the first place would not outweigh Woodhead's rights under the act. And that's a decision that's pretty consistent with what you're going to see. If you've got a right to engage in advocacy, and this wasn't even aggressive advocacy, regarding an issue, employers be careful about, how you're going to clap back there. And here the employer went too far, and the state commission smacked him for it and determined that that was illegal. Probably a lot of backstory here. You don't get the email, you don't get the first email, you certainly don't get the second email, and then you don't get an unfair labor practice if everybody's getting along. So lots of stuff going on there. I'd be very interested to hear about it, and if I hear anything more interesting, I'll let you know. But interesting case out of New Jersey. Employers, be careful about the ways that you communicate to your union president. They don't work for you when it comes to union stuff, right? The other stuff, yeah, maybe they do. We're going to stay in New Jersey for our final case. Going to go to Hudson County. And this was a decision issued by the State Labor Commission's Director of Unfair Practices on February 10th in case number DUP number 2025-5. That's called Hudson County. This is a really interesting case. It's an unusual case. With a pretty typical fact pattern, and why we're talking about it, because I was surprised by the outcome. So what was happening here? PBA 109 represents employees in a bargaining unit at the county jail in Hudson County. And they were in the midst of negotiations with Hudson County for a new collective bargaining agreement. One of the proposals that the county was making in those negotiations was to change the shift worked by COs to a 12-hour shift. That was motivated in large part because of staffing difficulties that the county was having, right? This is not unique to New Jersey. It's not unique to Hudson County. It's always been hard to recruit and retain correctional officers, and it has gotten much, much worse. And this dispute took place in July, August of 2022, right? It takes a while for these things to bubble up. And so, oh man, we're still even in COVID at that point. So we had all the regular craziness, but you've got COVID as well, still around in 2022. And so the staffing issues in the county jail were a big deal. So the county wants to change the schedule. The union is opposed to a 12-hour shift. I'm not sure what the underlying reasons were. Not uncommon, though. Probably what's happening, though, I'll tell you. You had officers working eights or tens that were getting stuck anyway. They couldn't leave because they weren't relieved, and they were probably working 12 or 16 anyhow. And I've been in places like this where they say, "Well, now you're going to schedule me for 12 automatically, and then what happens if I get stuck after that?" It's a really long time. Don't know what the dynamics were. What I do know is that on July 16th of 2022, an officer was working a weekend shift and was almost killed by an inmate, right? Assaulted by an inmate, knocked unconscious. Inmate took his keys, let himself out, and let a lot of other people out. It was an extraordinarily dangerous situation. The officer was lucky not to lose his life, and that we didn't have any other serious injuries, additional serious injuries. In the wake of that, the county said, "We're gonna make some changes here." They contacted the union and they said, "Hey, we've been talking about this 12-hour shift. I know we're in the middle of negotiations and you guys have been opposing it, but we want you to just agree to implement it now. Can we just implement that right now? We'll keep talking because we believe that the way that we can structure the 12s, that'll make us better able to cover vacancies. This particular shift this week, primarily on weekend shifts, they were short-staffed. They said, hey, these serious staffing issues are what are putting us in this bind. We think the 12s will help us. The officers didn't feel that way. It's a big issue. The county wanted 12-hour shifts. It might have been their biggest issue in negotiations, and they were asking the union to basically concede on the biggest issue. Not sure what the dynamics were there. And by the way, 12-hour shifts are not a magic wand. It doesn't mean you're automatically going to have, magically more people. Maybe some of those issues were raised by the union in that discussion. So the union talked about it, said, we're not willing to agree to 12s. Let's just settle the contract. Maybe we'll get 12s as part of the contract, but let's keep talking, but we're not going to do anything now. What the jails did in response is they said, well, if you don't agree to 12s, we're going to make some changes here because we're not going to let this happen again. Union said, what does that mean? They found out because when the union said, we're not going to move to 12-hour shifts, the jails immediately moved. They didn't change shift length, but they changed schedules, and they moved around people's work weeks to better cover the weekends. So people who had weekends off didn't have weekends off anymore, or didn't have weekends off as frequently. And they did this for 67 members, not the entire unit, but a significant chunk of the bargaining unit found themselves being regularly scheduled on weekends, with very little notice of that change. That resulted in an unfair practice charge. The union filed a ULP or requested to file an unfair practice charge with the State Labor Commission, and arguing that this was a unilateral change, right, to a working condition. And of course, that's what happens. You change somebody's schedule length, you change somebody's days off. These are like bread and butter, basic things that employers are going to have to bargain over. The reason we're talking about this case, though, is the commission, they review charges and they investigate and they decide whether to move forward with the charge. They elected to dismiss the ULP charge, and they determined that in this case, Hudson County had a managerial prerogative to change the schedules at issue here in order to address staffing shortages and to ensure officer and inmate safety. So that's an exception to the general rule. It's very, very interesting that the commission took that position. So, how did the commission arrive at the decision not to issue an unfair practice charge? Well, what the director of the unfair practices unit determined was that in this instance, the county had a managerial prerogative to change schedules under the specific circumstances that were presented, right? And so the director acknowledged that work schedules are generally mandatorily negotiable. Despite that, there are some occasions where an employer can unilaterally change them if, right, it's a big if maintaining the status quo and not changing them would somehow substantially interfere with government policy determination, such as ensuring public safety. And looking at the facts in this case, which was a significant staffing shortage, particularly on the weekends, and a serious assault on a correctional officer on a weekend, which the county was trying to address, those were pretty important facts. So the director noted that the staffing shortage, right, coupled with this near fatal attack on the officer, created a situation where the county could no longer responsibly operate under the existing schedule. And so the director determined that the county's actions here in moving schedules around to cover weekends was necessary to increase officer and inmate safety and to reduce the likelihood of future dangerous incidents. Another argument that, and that's a, you know, it's an extraordinary outcome, but they're extraordinary facts. But you know what? Are they really that extraordinary? If you think about what's going on in jails these days and over the last few years, they're all understaffed and it's a lot more dangerous. But we have real people who are working these jobs, who have lives to lead. And it's a little bit of short-term versus long-term thinking. And I'm sure that this came up in negotiations, and there were probably negotiations along the way, but changing the schedules unilaterally, affecting the lives of these 67 officers who are now forced to work on the weekends when you are dying for new employees, is that a good long-term strategy? I wonder what happened to those 67 officers. I guarantee you, some of those 67 officers, when they were told you just got to lump the new schedule, I guarantee you some of them walked. They just split. And now you got a worse problem, right? So, it's one thing to have a managerial right. It's another thing to execute it, right? It's another thing to use it. And it might help you right now, but is it really going to just make your problem worse? Another interesting thing that came up in this case was a past practice argument that the union raised. And then basically, the union said, look, we have a practice here of arranging schedules the way we arrange them so that weekends are protected. And the court, or of course, the director noted that there is language in the contract. And I would say that there's not great language in the collective bargaining agreement that does kind of address the employer's ability to schedule. And that this is a grievance, if anything, and we're not going to wade into that. And so the director determined that any of these past practice arguments were contractual, don't warrant our involvement. Essentially, go ahead, file a grievance if you want. Let me tell you what the contract says with respect to schedules. Not great for the union. It says the county retains the full managerial discretion to schedule the 2 consecutive days off that the officer shall receive. That is, the county is not required to grant officers on the 5-2 work schedule weekends off. Okay. Other provisions in the contract, but that's not great, right? That's going to give a lot of discretion to the employer to do maybe exactly what they did. And so, not sure if the union's going to have a lot of success in that grievance. And so, interesting case, unusual facts, not as uncommon as you might think in corrections. And it, re I'm talking about it because, it really does show some of the strange outcomes that we get because of the extraordinary staffing concerns that we're facing in departments. I think, we've talked actually about a couple of different prison-related cases where we had unusual outcomes related to scheduling, and it all comes from this question of we just don't have enough people to do the job. The only way you're going to get enough people to do the job is to pay them and treat them like professionals. And you got to think short term versus long term. And so this might have gotten through an emergency. I wonder if it made the staffing situation worse. It happened in 2022. I hope things have gotten better between the summer of 22 and the spring of 2025 in the Hudson County Jail. If you know the answer, let me know and I will share it with other folks. Hopefully, it's gotten better for everybody. But we shall see. And if there's any developments, we'll let you know. Okay, we made it to the end of the podcast. Just me this month. Next month, we'll come back. We'll talk to somebody. I don't even know who we're going to talk to, but we'll talk to somebody. And there'll always be new and interesting cases. In the meantime, if you're interested in what we do, check us out at LRIS.com. Just a reminder, Rights of Police seminar coming up in June. And then we've got 3 seminars in September, October, November, all in Vegas. It's going to be a great Las Vegas year. If you like what you hear, follow, subscribe, text it to other people. The more, the merrier, as far as I'm concerned. All right, Rick Polson from the City of Brotherly Love, signing off. Hoping everybody has a great month.